movies and musicals with Aideen Gormley on 96 to 99 RTE Lyric FM.
Special guest on Movies and Musicals this afternoon, and of course newly released music at the moment brings with it extra excitement, as we're so starved of live music, being able to record music on a big scale due to COVID-19. Can I ask you firstly, when did you record this album? How long ago?
We started it in November last year, and we finished it just literally before the lockdown. I mean literally the day before. Fortunately, when we were locked down, then we could do all the reviewing and editing and fiddling around that we had to do afterwards. But so we just, yeah, we sneaked in under the wire with it, which is good.
It really is. The type of recording you've done here, though, it does feel like we are literally very close to the piano. Is that what you wanted to achieve?
Yes, I didn't start out with any particular agenda for the album. And then when Simon started to play me the arrangements he'd done, I realized two things. One was that it was very much a piano album rather than an album of just in a collection of themes, that it was an album of piano pieces that he was going to do. And that was so nice. And then when we started to work on them together and think about them, we thought it would be good to have, if we could find a really great piano, which we did, then it would be really nice if you could sort of hear the dampers lifting and him breathing almost, you know, that you kind of felt that you were standing right next to the piano and he was playing for you. And that's kind of what we went for.
So many film themes to choose from, though, George. How did you make those decisions in terms of what Simon was going to play?
Well, that sort of, in a way, was self-selecting, because I decided that it would be a mistake to just focus on things that were better known if they weren't things that lent themselves to, you know, piano pieces, really. So we just took everything on its merit, and we had a very, very long list to begin with, and then we cut it down. And even when we went in, I think we expected that we would record, you know, we'd probably discard 6 or 7 of the titles, but in the end we recorded more than I thought. So we ended up recording 24 titles.
Which we will come to in a moment. Tell me more about your working relationship with Simon. You go way back. I know you worked on Mrs. Henderson Presents together, so you've had a long working relationship.
We have. I mean, Mrs. Henderson, the film, he was the musical director. And I did a lot of research into sort of English music, sort of like post that period in the 30s, which was almost like post ragtime, pre swing. It was a really interesting time for, you know, jazz and popular music in the UK. And he was really into it. So when I said after I finished the film, and I was talking to him, and I said, you know, actually, I think it might make a musical, that Mrs. Henderson. And he said, well, if you're going to do that, you've got to let me write it with you, because, you know, we're so bang into the style and everything. Mm. I said, okay. And that's literally how I just said, okay. I mean, and then we did. And it was actually, it was really nice and to work with him. But I know him because there was a famous recording studio in London called Olympic Studios, which was in Barnes. The engineer there, the chief engineer there, used to record all my film scores. And he was near the studio one day, and he went to the pub where there's a jazz club, the Bull in Barnes. It's quite famous. And the main act hadn't come on yet. But before they played, there was this kid playing the piano. And he was playing Stride, which is, you know, kind of in the style of Teddy Wilson and people like that. And he was playing Stride piano, and Keith, the engineer, was so impressed that he said to him, listen, I don't know where you come from or what you're doing, but anytime you want to practice, you can come in and use one of the rooms that's not in use in the studios. And he did. So people then, whenever we went in to record, there would be this lunatic in one of the rooms playing away, madly playing away, jazz and this and that and the other. And eventually, in a conversation with Keith, I said, well, a thing, and I decided I may as well give him a session to do. So he came in and played a session, and that was many years ago now, and he's played virtually everything I've done since.
Well, that's interesting when you talk about the sort of stride and jazz. It brings us, I think, to You've Got Mail, which for me, listening to it over the last few days, has that wonderful American sound, that sort of laid back, jazzy feel to it. And Simon plays it really beautifully. Can you bring us back to working with Nora Ephron on You've Got Mail and the original score? And then perhaps we'll hear what Simon did with that theme.
Oh, yeah. Well, Nora Ephron was one of the greatest experiences as a person to meet in my entire career. She was just wonderful and hilariously funny and absolutely fanatical about the music in her films, the songs, the music, the everything about it. She was forensic about the lyrics to every song and whether or not they worked exactly in the way that she wanted. And she was very, very hands-on, but she had a delightful kind of sensibility that's in all her films, I think. And I absolutely loved working with her. We've always worked in New York, and it was, it was one of the happiest experiences for me. And everyone knows this, but she was a very, very funny woman and very, very smart. And when we did You Got Mail, she only really had two comments she'd ever make to me about music. One was she'd say, "I love it." And then, or "I don't love it." It was either one of the two. "Don't love it" was about as negative as you could get. And "I love it" was about as positive as you could get. And that was the great thing about Nora. There was no in between. You know, she either loved it or she didn't love it.
And so you knew where you stood.
Yeah, fortunately, she loved the music for You've Got Mail. And we had a really, really happy time.
In terms of what Simon does with this particular theme, then I know that Simon has said you gave him absolute freedom. But if you could introduce it to us in terms of what Simon has done with the You've Got Mail theme on this album.
Yeah, well, what he's done is he's extracted parts of the score, but essentially what the theme, the bits that he's playing, focus on two things. The first time that she sends. When she's sort of alone, Meg Ryan, and she sends an email, which begins or ends, "Good night, dear void," she says. And she's basically sending it into the nowhere. And then later on, when she still doesn't know who Tom Hanks is, she's forced to close the bookshop, her bookshop. And when she closes it, she turns the sign saying "closed." And as she turns the sign saying "closed," she looks back into the shop, which is now empty, and she sees her mother swinging her around, dancing when she was a little girl. She has this kind of vision of herself, and it's her last memory of the bookshop. And then she goes out the door and shuts the door. And it's so the music I wrote for it has this kind of lilting, slightly jazzish quality, which was then played in an orchestra, and Simon just beautifully transcribed that as a piano piece, and that's what he plays.
Music of George Fenton from You've Got Mail. George Fenton, my special guest on Movies and Musicals this afternoon. George, you have worked with so many different directors over the years. I want to talk about Richard Attenborough, and specifically about Shadowlands, one of my favourites, I have to say. And I know Richard Attenborough has said it was perhaps his favourite film. I understand, in terms of working with Richard Attenborough, he was very much into the collaborative process. You were there sort of early days of the project, is that right?
Yes, he was one of the few people. And he's gone on record so many times saying this, he couldn't understand why the composer was somebody who was left to come in at the last moment. He said he thought that music was so important to his films that it was essential that the composer was there throughout the filming process so that he was involved or she was involved in decisions and ways of doing things. And of course, in the case of Shadowlands, there was a very strong case for that because there was music within the film itself that they shot, that I wrote. So I wrote two anthems for the choir of Magdalen College to sing. And obviously they had to be ready quite early on. And then they also contained motifs musically that I then used in the rest of the score, which I recorded much later with the LSO. But Dickie Attenborough was a very wonderful mix because on the one hand, he loved music and he was very musical and he was absolutely enthusiastic for what the music would be. On the other hand, he was a very shrewd person in the sense that he would say to me over and over again, oh, it's going to be great, it's going to be marvelous, but he wouldn't involve himself in listening. So as opposed to Nora, for example, who we were just talking about, Nora would listen to every single thing as I wrote it, and I would see her, you know, daily or every other day. Mm. And she would listen to this, listen to that, make comments, etc. Richard Attenborough would never listen to anything until he came to the studio. And he would, by doing that, he very smartly realized that if he didn't join in the process of kind of whether this is right or wrong or what, he in the end, he knew that if he left me alone, that the pressure I put on myself would be so much greater. It was quite a subtle tactic, really. Yeah. And of course, that's what happened. I mean, by the time I got to actually record Shadowlands, you know, I was a wreck because no one had heard it. And the LSO were in the studio and it was like now or never, you know. And yeah. So he was brilliant like that. And of course, he was so important to me as well that I worked incredibly hard for him. You know, I so wanted to please him. And of course, Shadowlands is so involved personally for me with my background in music and where I grew up and everything. So,
I mean, it's a heartbreaking story, obviously, with Deborah Winger and Anthony Hopkins so extraordinary in it. But what a beautiful, beautiful theme. I mean, George, you are a master of melodies, I always think. You know, your music stands alone without the visual image, which is always a bonus for me in terms of playing it on the radio and obviously for Simon to play it on this album. But do you remember when you hit upon this stunning theme for Shadowlands?
I do. And I remember it was very, very late at night. And I sort of just started playing it. And I remember thinking, oh, well, this is good. It's a theme that descends, but it's climbing. Each phrase is climbing. And that's kind of good for this. And it sounds quite English. And then I thought, I better leave it and come back to this tomorrow because I'm not sure if I've actually written this or this is something else. So I left it then and I went away, and then the next day I started on it again, and then I sort of really, really drilled into it, and actually it became this single motif that is the tune, became almost the germ of the whole score then. And I think I was just focused on its Englishness in a way, you know. And sometimes I try not to think where things come from, because, or how they come to me, because a bit of mystery is okay, you know.
Absolutely.
As long as I know that it's mine and I've actually thought it up, because sometimes obviously you go, oh, that's good, and you go, no wonder that's good, that's by somebody else. You know, but in this case, yeah, it was that one night. I can remember exactly where I was and I can remember the night. It was a nice feeling. And I was orchestrating the score as well. And so I sort of started and it kick-started that whole process, which is, if you have time as a composer to orchestrate your own stuff, it's the most precious and fabulous moment when you literally control every note you're putting on the page, and you can imagine everything, and you have the luxury of the time to do it, and it makes it very, very personal when you actually go and conduct the orchestra. And yeah. Some of the orchestrators I work with are fantastic, don't get me wrong. I mean, they do things I couldn't do. They're so smart. Mm. But there's something always very, very nice about everything being your own thing, you know.
I wanted to come to your unique collaborations too with Ken Loach. I presume when Ken Loach phones you to score a film, it's an immediate yes, is it?
Yes. Yes, and he's phoned me quite a few times, so I'm happy to say, because I think I've done now 17 films of his.
Yeah, I'd love to come to a slight Irish angle on this, George, because of course you have scored both The Wind That Shakes the Barley and Jimmy's Hole for Ken Loach. When it came to The Wind That Shakes the Barley, an absolutely brilliant film, do you remember touching on listening to Irish music at all as a matter of interest, or what was your approach?
I did. My mother's side is Irish, you know, and so I've always had an affinity with Irish music, and I went weirdly, which is quite unusual for me and on films, but I went to the shoot. And I spent a little bit of time there. And so I met the woman, you know, that sang The Wind That Shakes the Barley, and heard some of the tales of the local stories about people had about that time and those troubles. And it was important. In the end, the score didn't particularly focus on it being Irish, because working for Ken is quite unusual in the sense that he likes having music in his films, but he likes the music to just emanate from the film itself.
Mm. He doesn't let you look at a script, sure he doesn't.
No, he doesn't look at a script any more than he lets the actors. Mm. And he wants me when he invites me to see the film when he's basically got it finished. I never see or read anything before then.
Okay.
And I see it. I mean, this is a very unique way of working.
Yeah.
I see it, and we have a cup of coffee afterwards, and we go straight to the cutting room, and we spot where the music's going. That's it. It's kind of like all done in that one little window. And sometimes I make changes, but generally speaking, what we decide that day, because I've seen it for the first time fresh, I give him my reaction. Of course, I don't know the film very well by then, but I give him my reaction and we talk about it. And he's very interested in always in talking about how music can work without it, without the film having the artifice of music, if that makes sense.
Yeah.
So if the music comes from out of the film, like almost out of the ground, that's good. But he doesn't want anything that smacks of, in inverted commas, film music, that somehow is there to manipulate the audience's response. And of course, one of the things about film music is that is what it's there for.
Gosh, so a whole different way of working. What about with Neil Jordan? You have worked on three of his films, The Company of Wolves in 84, High Spirits in 88, and We're No Angels in 1989. Can we come to We're No Angels? Because you've the main theme from it on this album. People remember it, starring Robert De Niro and Sean Penn. What is your memory of that time back in 89?
Well, We're No Angels was a very sort of Hollywood movie, you know, big cast, big budget, big sets, and shooting in Canada and blah, blah, blah. And I loved doing it. And when I recorded it, I used the classic Hollywood orchestra, which involves, as well as being a full symphony orchestra, always had saxophones. The Hollywood orchestras always had saxophones. And the saxophones, you know, worked like woodwinds in the woodwind colors in the middle of the orchestra. And we did this score Abbey Road with an enormous forces. Like, I don't know, I think I had 92 in the orchestra. It was huge. And it was great. And there was this one theme in it, which was called Molly's Theme, which was basically Demi Moore's tune, as it were, in the film. And Simon, when he heard that, when he heard the music, played him the music for We're No Angels, and he said, oh, I could do this in a, and he, what he's done is he's done it in a very, very specific way. When I spoke earlier on to you about post-ragtime, mm-hmm. he's played We're No Angels in an American way, which is post-ragtime. It's almost like playing ragtime, the way he plays it, but it's just veering into more of a kind of a stride style. And one of the things that's amazing about Simon, and one of the reasons why he's so perfect for this album, is that being the session player he is, he not only can play in any style, but he can play from, like, within the style. You know, he's not sort of, he's not just hamming it up, you know. And I've always tried when I write to write from within the style I'm trying to write, to get to know the music or the culture of the music well enough that I'm kind of comfortable writing in it as myself rather than just doing a pastiche or something. And so for that, he's really reflected everything I could hope for. And in We're No Angels, he does this absolutely beautifully, I think.
We're No Angels, the music of George Fenton, my guest on Movies and Musicals this afternoon. We've time for one more theme, I think, George, and I'd love to come to Dangerous Liaisons, one of my favourites, and such an interesting score for you, because I suppose your approach had to sort of adopt that style of Baroque music prevalent in aristocratic society of the time. So tell us about, you know, capturing sort of the Vivaldi, the Bach, the Handel, the Gluck, and then making it your own and providing this wonderful score.
It was a great opportunity, Dangerous Liaisons, and when they'd finished shooting, I met with Stephen Frears, the director. We had assumed when he was shooting that we would use a lot of period music. I mean, you've mentioned three composers that are in the film: Gluck, Vivaldi, Bach, Handel. When they are all in the film, but when I thought that the score would be that way, you know, and we met, and Stephen said, well, what do you think? So I played him something. I said, aren't we going to do this thing? And he kind of looked slightly disappointed. And he said, well, I don't know. And he said, I mean, shouldn't it be more like North by Northwest?
Oh.
And I said, oh, okay. And he said, and of course, I then realized that this was because he'd framed, If for anybody that's interested in these things, the framing of Dangerous Liaisons, like all the close-ups and the way they're lit and the framing itself, had referred to films like Notorious, and there are actual quotes, like framing-wise, from Notorious.
I never knew that. Wow.
Yeah. No, it's really interesting. Mm. Of course, when I looked at it that way, and I thought, okay, yeah. So actually the dynamic is Bernard Herrmann. So what I've got to do now is I've got to find a way to make a kind of Baroque / early classical orchestra sound like they're playing Bernard Herrmann. and actually I think in some respects that's what I did do.
You did, and, yeah.
And so that's where the marriage and the funny mix of what the music in Dangerous Liaisons came from, really from his one instruction that unlocked the whole score. And so I credit him for that. And,
another great collaboration. And then Simon needs to come along and go piano only on it. So how did that work out?
It's a phenomenally difficult piece to play on the piano because he's playing two parts in the left hand and this very rapid accompaniment in the right hand. But he really, really wanted to do it. And he loves the sort of he's funny because he absolutely loves the malevolence of the music from Dangerous Liaisons. And he was determined that he was going to be able to make an arrangement and do it. And he did it. And I love it. So, yeah, it's great.
Music of George Fenton from Dangerous Liaisons, from this wonderful new album, The Piano Framed, themes by George Fenton, arranged and performed by Simon Chamberlain. Just a final question before we let you go, George. It's, you know, I was reading the sleeve notes you wrote for this release, and you were saying you were cocooning while you were writing them. You also often, of course, stand in front of an orchestra to conduct your music, especially the natural history pieces in front of audiences and arenas. How are you feeling at the moment in terms of music, in terms of orchestras coming together again? What are your thoughts?
I'm very concerned that the orchestras survive. I can't wait to get back personally. But my main thing that I really, really would, I hope people in government and things will really think through, is that if you let these orchestras are institutions and they take decades to build their sound, their ethos, the way that they program, the kind of players that play, etc., etc. And it would be a terrible tragedy if this situation meant that they disappeared and couldn't come back. So I'm only hoping that the rescue packages and that people generally will realize just the depth of talent and the resource that music is, particularly live music, is for everybody, is such a source of joy and so important to people. I really, really make a plea for it to be protected and to survive.
Well, I couldn't agree more. And you've also said that this album makes for particularly calm listening during these times when we need music so much, which is very, very true. George Fenton, such a pleasure to talk to you. Thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you so much.
Movies and Musicals with Aideen Gormley.